Supreme Court law clerk, professor of law at University of California, Berkeley, author of many books, has a tremendous intuitive way of looking at a lot of the issues that we face, that our society is wrestling with. This morning he's come to share his story with us, and it's always exciting for me as I work with the gathering in not only Orange County but the other areas around Southern California to get to interact with these speakers, men like yourself who are successful in their careers, but come to points in their career path where they discover some deeper truths and more extensive values that are really more eternal in their consequences. And so we are really blessed this morning to have with us Professor Philip Johnson. Would you welcome him?
Well, good morning to you all. It's fine to be here at another men's prayer breakfast for the gathering. I've heard at my table that there was some curiosity about how you could have a Christian speaker from Berkeley, from the University of California at Berkeley. It reminded me of the tape I received from someone in Kansas of a sermon that had been given at a Bible church out there. And the theme of this sermon was that God can do anything. He can reach any sinner. And the example that the preacher gave was Philip Johnson, a professor at the University of California at Berkeley. And if God can reach Philip Johnson, while there is no sinner so far gone in iniquity that he's beyond the power of God to reach his heart. Now, the preacher didn't mean that I had committed a particularly vile crime or anything. It was just that I was in Berkeley, and a professor at that institution whose reputation for wickedness and atheism is much exaggerated, as it happens. Although there is some basis for it. His joke reminded me of a saying that Mexicans have. They say, poor Mexico, so far from God, so close to the United States. Berkeley, so far from God. That is the University of California at Berkeley, which is, in fact, treating me very well. I told a reporter the other day, probably better than I deserve, somehow. Now, do you ever think about the foundation for your life? That is, the basis that you build on for everything else. Well, probably you don't. Not many of us do. It's like a house. You take the foundation for granted. You aren't always saying, gosh, is the house going to topple over on its side while I'm sitting here in the living room? You take that for granted, and you're living up there in the kitchen and the dining room and the bedrooms, assuming that your foundation is solid, until something like an earthquake hits and makes you think about it. Now, I've had those earthquakes in my life. I started out as a young man in a career with the idea that the really important thing in life was to get ahead in the race for the honors of the world. Well, if you were a scientist, you wanted to get the Nobel Prize. If you were a lawyer, as I was, you wanted to be a professor at the best university, perhaps, as I was, or a partner in the best law firm, or a Supreme Court justice. You name it, anything. At least you'd stay out of jail. That would be some accomplishment in itself. So that was my idea. And then in personal life, you'd think of a family and children. I had a marriage to a glamorous wife who was somewhat above my station when I was a nerdy student, and a family. And then I went in my 1930s through the kind of crisis people go through. The marriage broke up. I decided I wasn't quite as good at private life as I thought. I figured, well, if my parents could do it, surely I could do it a lot better. No doubt that's what my kids think. They can do better anything that the old man could do at all. And I had the career, but I discovered that it wasn't what I thought it would be. That I was writing scholarly papers for people that didn't want to read them, and textbooks that students bought and read because other professors and I assigned them to them. I had a great ambition. Someday I thought I'd love to write books that people buy because they want to read them and spend their own money for when they don't have to. I've achieved that now, and yet that too isn't quite enough to make a satisfying life. Well, I found that the career was not enough, was not the fulfillment that I thought it would be. That the marriage had been one of these things that did not last, although it was very good for a time. And it was those experiences that enabled me to humble myself quite enough to come to Christ and invite Christ into my life. Before that, I'd been a kind of agnostic who wasn't hostile to the Christian faith. I thought it was a good thing, but it was for other people who need that sort of thing. Not for us modern thinkers. And I had to come to realize that what I had wasn't as good as what I thought it was. So that was my conversion, as you would say, but it's not the end of the story. Because later I had an experience that brought that foundation home to me in a way that not even the crises of my earlier period had done. I was vacationing at a beach home near Monterey, California, with friends and their children. I love the children and my wife, having a good relaxing time, and I went down to take a nap on Friday the 13th, wouldn't you know it? And while I was napping, I had a stroke. I got up. I didn't know what had happened to me. I was just a little confused. My friends called my wife. She took a look at me and said, "You got to go to the emergency room." I thought, well, I'll do this to humor her, but they'll just send me away and say, "Quit bothering us. This place is for sick people." They did no such thing. They put me in an ambulance and sent me straight to the hospital, where I remained for some time. In that hospital room, my left arm was an unmanageable claw. I couldn't do anything with it. I had no feeling on the left side of the body. I had had what the doctors later told me was quite a severe stroke. I didn't know how severe it was at the time. Fortunately, it was a right brain rather than a left brain stroke. A left brain stroke would have affected my language ability and recognition. I'm sure I wouldn't be speaking here today. The right brain affected feeling on the left side and some organizational things, but that's not so bad, and at least for somebody who has always made his living and career out of language. So there I was in the hospital, and a number of friends from that beach house and from my church came around the next day with children, and we all prayed for a miracle of healing, a miracle of healing. I didn't know what was going to happen then, but after my friends all left, I said to someone, probably my wife, I said, I think I've had miracle enough for today, just being with the body of Christ as I have been. In fact, if heaven is an eternity of love, I've had an hour of it. And I felt like it's never going to end. What had most affected me during that hour of heaven on earth was a friend of ours, a trained singer, a marvelous singer named Kate, who sang a familiar hymn, "On Christ the Solid Rock I Stand, All Other Ground is Sinking Sand." Now, I'd always thought of songs, oh, that's lovely, and Kate's voice is lovely, but it's just something to please the ear. This time, I thought of it as a question. Exactly what are you standing on? Now, the question wasn't, am I going to become a Christian? I was a Christian, and even a fairly well-known Christian author and speaker, and yet I had to ask myself at this moment, am I standing on the solid rock, or am I just a little bit confused about that? You'll find, those of you who are Christians know this, and those of you who become Christians will see this, that a constant process of checking and accountability is very good for your spiritual life. You know what the truth is, but you know how important the basement, the foundation to your house is, but maybe you haven't thought about it for a little while, and you need to do that. That's what I was doing. And I realized, yes, I was standing on the solid rock. This was not a conversion experience. It was an experience of realizing just what I was standing on and how solid that foundation, that basement was. And so as we prayed, I thought, well, the miracle has already started. I don't know where this is going to end, but it's on its way. I have the faith and courage I need to face the challenges that I now have to face. And I didn't know what they might be. Someone had told me that after one stroke, you're 10 times as likely to get a second one. So I was thinking, well, when is the second one going to come along? Am I perhaps going to spend the remaining years of my life not as a source of strength and support for my loved ones and my wife and others, but as a drain on them, as someone whose last years will be remembered, well, you know, how horrible it was to take care of him and put up with him. That was much more terrifying to me than death itself. In fact, I even for a time sort of wished I could just die. As a Christian, obviously, I couldn't think of suicide, and even if I could, plastic knives and that they give you in the hospital wouldn't be much help with that. But I'm just making it as a joke to tell you that there are things that will frighten a man more than death, and the thought of complete helplessness was more frightening to me than death. So in that hospital room, I read the 23rd Psalm, something everyone knows well, and certainly I did, and I remember those words, I have... Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, the valley of the shadow of death. Beautiful words, a beautiful poem, but it means so much more to me now. Because I've been there, I have walked in the valley of the shadow of death, brushing against eternity all the way. And when you've done that, you come back as a changed man. You're not the same person that you were before. And I thank God for that, too. Another book of the Bible that I read, again, and I've always admired, was the book of Job. But I thought of it as a kind of a philosophical argument about the nature of evil and suffering, with two bookends, a fantastic story about how Satan says to God, you know, your servant Job honors you and he blesses you, but after all, you've always blessed him. You've given him wealth and abilities and family and everything. Let me take those away from him, and then we'll see what he's like. And that seemed kind of arbitrary. Well, that couldn't be true, or that didn't make any sense. It's just a fable. But now, when I read the book of Job, I thought, gee, I can imagine that happening to me. I can imagine Satan saying to God, well, it's Philip Johnson. He talks a good talk. He gives a Christian testimony. He honors you, but he's always been blessed. He's had good health all his life, even though he hasn't done much to take care of it. He's had enough of a brain to get himself a education at the best law schools and a position on the faculty of the University of California at Berkeley and so on. Probably that's what he really trusts on, and he's grateful to God only insofar as God has given him these good things. So how about letting me send a blood clot up his carotid artery, the right side, and see what happens and see what he's like after that. And I thought, as I thought of that, you know, I can imagine myself saying to God, yes, do it, because I will otherwise never know who I really am. That this experience was somehow necessary to form the complete person so that I would know who I was. And so the book of Job became much more of a living part of my own life than it had ever been before. During the time to come, I faced many challenges. The first challenge, one of the biggest challenges, was learning to walk again. I had to learn all over again. Yeah, you saw me walk up here, and you noticed that I'm probably not ready for championship tennis quite yet. But I do walk around very well, get around the block, and take public transportation into my office. So the walking is going pretty well. That's the miracle of healing. It isn't finished yet, but perhaps as you can see, it's well underway. And I can tell you a little story about that also relates to the Bible. I did some strenuous physical therapy while I was in the hospital. I had a lot of trainees from Germany, lovely German girls, paying a lot of attention to me. It wasn't so bad, guys. And they had the great guru, a woman who was the founder of their school of physical therapy, an older woman named Sue, who came to give a demonstration class, and they picked me to be the subject of this class. What an honor! I was really proud. So she worked me over for a good hour of strenuous exercise, and my wife was there. And at the end of that, she said, "Now get up," she said, and she held out her hand. She said, "Take my hand, and let's walk across the gymnasium floor. Let's walk across the floor to your wife who's over there. Let's take a few steps." Now, I had taken a few tottering steps with a walker and holding on to a rail, but that is all. She said, "Let's get over there." And that's what we did. I was holding her arm and walked over to my wife. Pretty impressive so far, isn't it? You can imagine how impressed I was, but it's not all. She said, "Now, take your wife. Take Kathy's hand instead of mine. And the two of you walk the length of the gym over to the other end. You can do it." And that is exactly what we did. We walked the length of that gym together. And I said after that, I've read this story of Peter walking on the water because Jesus said, "You can do it, walk over here." Some people have trouble believing that, but I don't. I've done it. I admit it wasn't really water if you take that kind of literal view of things. It was a gymnasium floor. But the experience was the same, and our faith did not falter. We had the faith and courage to do what needed to be done. Sue later explained to the trainees, we were horrified that she had done that, and they said, "Well, I'm very experienced. I've been doing this for decades, and I could see from his exercises that he had enough strength and balance that he would be able to do it if I challenged him." See, the trainees were horrified because they'd been held in fear of American tort lawyers, you know, if there were any accidents. So I guess that's the miracle, is that she had the faith and courage to defy the tort lawyers and have me walk. That's enough of a miracle for me, certainly. And then I am an author and public speaker nowadays in my retirement from law school teaching. I had a contract before the stroke that I was having trouble fulfilling. It was to produce a book for my publisher, InterVarsity Press, and I'd written several books, and I guess I wasn't sure I had anything more to say. Now, to write a book after you've had a stroke is difficult. It has difficulties. Typing, obviously, I couldn't use my left hand. My wife challenged me to complete the book. She gave what any stroke survivor really needs, a combination of challenge and support. Challenge and support. She kept me at it and kept helping me to get it done. And I found that, you know, typing isn't the hard part of writing a book. Typing with one hand and pecking a little bit with the index finger of the other hand is quite adequate for writing a book, if that's all you can do. It's the ideas. It's the flow of ideas. It's really having something to say and having it come out. Now, because I had a right brain stroke, I had difficulty organizing ideas, now, organizing anything, getting my clothes on in the right order, or and anything that involves that sorting and organizing. I'll tell you, if you think of me as a computer, the files are still there. The programs are still there, but the files have all been shuffled, and I can't necessarily find them right away. But that isn't the hardest thing either. With a little help with that, I was able to complete the book on schedule, a book that I hadn't been able to do before the stroke. because I'd found I had something to say. It's coming out this summer from InterVarsity Press. It's called The Right Questions. I don't mind if you buy it. That's all right. It addresses all the things I've been thinking about all my life. Now, then I had another experience. Now, I had the experience of lying in a hospital bed and feeling that perhaps what I had always relied on in my life was that brain. See, that was what I thought was the solid rock on which I stood, the brain that had gotten me so far. And yet the brain was shattered, was severely damaged. That was another thing, that it wasn't permanent, it wasn't really a rock. Well, then, after I had been home from the hospital for a time, I got up early in the morning, as was my way, and I booted up my computer on September 11th, 2001. Just in time to see an airplane fly into one of the towers of the World Trade Center. I remember thinking, I sure hope this is the mother of all internet hoaxes. And then finding out in the aftermath what was going on. This fulfilled a certain feeling that I had had from the beginning. I said, you know, I've had a stroke. But actually, I think what's happened is that the world has had a stroke. I am just a minor example of something that's going on all over the place. The world has had a stroke. Its brain has been severely damaged or shattered. And as I saw all around the vast amount of confusion in the reactions to that, the vast amount of bad thinking coming out of particularly the centers of elite learning, the great universities of our culture, the places where I had been taught to think you went to see the smart people. The very worst confusion and misunderstanding seemed to be coming out of those places. There was a worldwide stroke, and a world really in need of having its brain put back together, restored, just as I did as an individual. So I discovered the world also needed a solid rock to stand on. My country, the United States of America, needed a solid rock to stand on. It needed to face some things that it had been facing away from, that it had been in denial about. Just that very first attack brought that home to me, as well as a number of things that happened thereafter. I read in the New York Times, one of the centers of this confused thinking I'm thinking about, a pretty good editorial that said that the terrorists selected the World Trade Towers in New York City for an attack because that was, and also the Pentagon, because that was the symbol of American power. That was what America stands for. That was where you went to see what was the very heart of America. And I thought, well, if the World Trade Center towers and the Pentagon are our towers of faith, that's what the Times had called them, that's what we have our faith in, the things that those represent, then we're in a lot of trouble. Because those towers have been shattered. They're on the ground. They're destroyed. Is it our commercial empire that we really believe in? Our military might? I thought not. And I wrote an editorial myself, an editorial that was for the Salem Radio Network, the nationwide network of Christian radio stations that I regularly do editorials for. And it was called, it was aired all over the country, Tottering Towers of Faith. And I said that the terrorists had made the same mistake in our generation that the Japanese militarists had made about the time I was born. December 1941, I was born in 1940. They had thought that the symbols of American power, that the American power was represented by those battleships at anchor in Pearl Harbor. And they discovered, as the Japanese admiral said after the event, after the successful strike, he said, "I fear we have only aroused a sleeping giant." And I wondered, maybe this is the case again. Maybe they have only aroused a sleeping giant. But as soon as those words went out, I wondered whether that was wishful thinking or truth. It's a little hard to tell, even now. In some respects, one can see it's true that a certain amount of sanity has crept back into life. People are saying things they didn't dare to say before. I find myself, to that extent, fairly encouraged. It was also a great time to come out with a book called The Right Questions, because I was able to ask, among the right questions in that book, you know, what went wrong with various things? Islam, what went wrong? Or was there something wrong at the beginning? America, what went wrong? You know, with the great American civilization. And I was able to suggest some of the things that I thought had gone wrong. One thing, which is why I won't go into the big picture, you know, after all, you've got to buy the book for that. One of things that went wrong was with the accounting profession. Just one aspect. My father, up until his death, was a partner in Arthur Andersen and Company, the great accounting firm. And I, you know, remember how proud he was of that firm and how its integrity, stability, was unquestioned in the days of my boyhood. And I can still remember my dad saying to me how important it was that accounting firms must never get involved in extraneous business relations with clients. You know, other than the strict accounting service, because it was absolutely important that they be able to fire the client at any time. And they also could not become dependent on any one client for too much business for the same reason. They had to maintain their independence. What went wrong? Well, Arthur Andersen and Company and other accounting firms had become business consultants, had become essentially partners in business with some of their clients. And they had become dependent on individual clients to an extent that they did not have the independence they needed to criticize their balance sheets. That was something that had gone wrong. Principles of integrity that were just taken for granted in my day slowly slipped away bit by bit. As we speak today, I'm reading headlines about the Pope in Rome meeting with all the American cardinals. And we get newspaper headlines that the Pope is saying such things as that sexual abuse by priests is a crime and a sin. That it would be necessary for the Pope or anyone else to say that would have been unheard of in the time of my boyhood. Things that were taken for granted as foundational to the integrity of the country or the Catholic Church, Protestant churches too, have slipped away bit by bit and need to be rebuilt. See, and sometimes things have slipped away bit by bit in our own personal lives. They need to be rebuilt. And maybe this raises a question of whether anything has gone wrong or whether something was just wrong at the start. You know, someone who has never been a Christian, who has always thought that the world provided all they need, might ask themselves that. They might say, well, wasn't I maybe wrong from the start? I never put my faith in the right place. I never built the foundation of the house right. When the house totters and falls, when it falls over on its side during an earthquake, we don't have to think about something new that's happened so much as that there was something wrong from the beginning. The foundation was never built right. On the other hand, a foundation might have been built right. It might have been solid, but we haven't kept up with the maintenance. The termites have gotten to it. In some other way, a solid foundation has become a little bit less than solid, which it will tend to do. Now, scientists talk about the second law of thermodynamics, which just, you know, means things tend to go to pieces rather than put themselves together if you leave them alone. It's best illustrated by a teenager's bedroom. If you want it to get messy, you don't have to do anything in particular. But if you want it to be cleaned up, Yeah, you'll have to exert a lot of purposeful energy.
Please stop your machine at this point and turn your cassette over to side two.
Life and with everybody's country. Things will go wrong if we don't keep up the maintenance. So I was very, very grateful when I found myself in that hospital room, not knowing how much I was ever going to recover my ability to walk and to get around as usual. I'm still working on things every morning, including this morning. I get up and copy a verse out of the Bible with my left hand. We won't call it calligraphy, but it's working on my brain to recognize that hand and help it go. So that's some of the maintenance that I'm doing and some to come up. Well, I was very thankful that I had a solid foundation there. I could say when Kate sang, "On Christ the solid rock I stand," well, yes, that's true, but I'm wondering if maybe I have only one foot on that solid rock and another one on something that's not quite so solid. See, and in that case, it may be that my weight at some crucial moment will be on the wrong foot, and I'll go over. So I also had that experience of having to make sure that the maintenance was practically done and to check my balance. And I discovered, as Sue, the great teacher of physical therapy, found, that my balance was pretty good, at least after I did some exercises. I had to do a lot of strenuous exercises with those German girls, who are pretty strict, some of them, you know, tradition, and to do other kinds of things to make sure that I was up to par. Now, when I did that, I found that there was a tremendous satisfaction in it. In the stroke hospital, in the rehabilitation hospital, the therapist told me one thing, is that they said, you know, you're going to have trouble recognizing names and faces. That's something that will come from this right brain stroke. But when I went home from the hospital, one of the first things I did is I went to a party. It was given a party of my law professor colleagues at Berkeley, some 50 of them. And I showed up and I amazed myself. I remembered every name and face. I remembered every name and face. How was I able to do that? Well, the answer, I think, is that because I knew I was challenged in that way, I made a study of it, remembering each one and, you know, thinking about it and not taking it for granted that I could do that. And I found that there are quite a number of things that I am now better at than I was before I suffered a stroke. The reason is that I took them for granted beforehand and assumed that I could do them without, and now I have to make a definite practice and study of it to be sure that I get it right. And those other people, I find, are more important to me than they used to be. One of the things that happens when you have lived in the valley of the shadow of death for a while is that you reevaluate the importance of things in your life. I had used to think, I was polite to people. It wasn't that I was rude to them necessarily, but I tended to think, well, what part do you play in my story? Do I have enough time to spend with you, to give you? The other people were always a part of my story. But after that experience in the hospital and meeting the other stroke sufferers and the therapists and the people who visited me, I thought, well, these people are really important, and the question is, what part do I play in their story? If I help this therapist to get better at her, you know, therapy, if I go to the hospital now and there's a clerk who's filling out the forms for me and so on, have I done something to make this day special for that clerk? I never would have thought that way beforehand. But it's just become natural for me to think that way, and I enjoy those encounters so much more. So life is in some ways more fulfilling. When my law school colleagues saw me at that party where I recognized their names and faces, they were astonished at how cheerful I was. I said, your attitude is so positive. What is it? And I said, well, you know, I have a lot of fun. And stroke therapy turns out to be a lot of fun. It's like it's like training for the Olympics, and I'm sure people who train for the Olympics have a lot of fun doing it, and a big satisfaction when they do it. So I said, so as far as having a stroke goes, I don't recommend it. It's not that much fun. But you should know that if you do have one, something like that happens to you, there is a positive side to it. I can tell you that for a certain. But there are things I'm enjoying now that I wouldn't have been capable of enjoying before, things I am able to do now that I would have been capable of doing now. So I would say that there has been a miracle of healing, even though my walk may be just a little bit unsteady. Now, what I would like to say for other people is you can get the benefit without having the stroke. You don't have to go through all of the downside, although you probably will go through something. Part of it, we all come to tragedies and death in the end. But we can have positive experiences throughout life and learn from them develop and have the feelings of accomplishment and satisfaction that a successful stroke recovery gives one without having the stroke. But what you need to have in order to do that is to have a foundation on which you can build. That's the first thing. You have to start with a foundation. And if your foundation is in the world, your foundation is in a job, a worldly success of some kind, as mine was, you don't have a proper foundation. You've got a house that is just waiting for a good blow, and it will fall over on its side. You don't have what you need. But then even if you do have a foundation at one time, if you set it, you've got to keep up with the maintenance. We all know that that's true, don't we? That with the house, with a car, and with anything else in life, you have to make sure that you're not allowing that foundation to decay, or perhaps putting one of your feet, the one that's carrying most of your weight perhaps, on something over to the side that will turn out to be slippery, that will turn out to be a sliding a sand. So I've known that. And so we might start, we can finish as I can complete my testimony today by thinking all of us of what these pointers mean for our own life. Heavenly Father, we give thanks that we can come together in your name, in the name of your Son, Jesus, for these sessions, this wonderful breakfast, these men who have come to learn more about you, perhaps to dedicate their lives to you, to check their foundations, to see if they were ever laid properly in the first place, and to see if the maintenance has been made. And so we can find, as I found with the wonderful people from the body of Christ who gathered in that hospital room on the day of my despair, that we don't have to do it alone, even humanly speaking. We have many brothers and sisters who will help us with the necessary job. And we will find that this is not just a matter of struggle or a matter of painful things. It isn't that we're doing things that aren't any fun now or they're painful in the hope of pie in the sky by and by, you know, in the hopes of something that comes after death. Eternal life is something you have promised us, and that is a fact, and it is to be taken into account. But eternity isn't just in the future. Eternity is also now. Remember, I had that hour of eternal love, and that was now. Eternity is also now, and the rewards also begin now. There may be difficult things to do and challenges, just as with training for the Olympics, but The rewards don't start when you're up there, you know, receiving a medal or something. The rewards from the accomplishment of the training and the competition begin before you've won the medal and persist even if you don't win a medal or if the bad judging takes it away from you, which sometimes happens too. So, Heavenly Father, we give thanks that it is possible for us to develop the foundation, to maintain it, and to live together now and also for eternity in your love. Now, at this point, I understand that there are gathering response cards here around the table. I've got one in my hand, and I don't know how it could have gotten there if you didn't have them all there. So